All right, welcome back. The Canadian Council of Innovators is calling on Alberta's premier to intervene because a regulatory group in our province, a powerful regulatory group, is trying to stop workers not registered with it from using the title software engineer. The key word here is engineer. So the Council of Canadian Innovators president says tech companies are not okay with this because they fear hiring good talent and not being able to ask people to apply for a job to become a software engineer is going to be tougher if the Association of Professional Engineers and Geoscientists in Alberta keeps insisting that software engineers must sign up with that regulatory group to use that title.
By not being able to use that term, it will really mean that they'll struggle to find the best talent to fill positions that they're currently hiring for. And in the innovation economy, highly skilled workers really is the jet fuel that create billion-dollar companies.
And I get this concern, because if you want to hire somebody, say, from overseas or somebody from Silicon Valley to fill a key role within your tech company in Alberta, you're going to post the job as a software engineer because that's what the rest of the world uses as the job description. Now, the province says it's concerned that Alberta's competitiveness could be impeded by this, and the province is encouraging the Council of Canadian Innovators and the Association of Professional Engineers and Geoscientists of our province to come together for a solution. Now, I'm highlighting this news story today as a jumping point into a broader discussion on what other speed bumps need to be smoothed out, so to speak, to keep Alberta's economy growing. So to help me dig into this, Scott Crockett is joining me this afternoon. Scott is VP of Communications with the Business Council of Alberta. Scott, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Ted. I'm thrilled to join you on this Friday afternoon.
I love chatting with you, Scott. You're one of the first people we thought of when we wanted to talk about this, because I know the Business Council of Alberta, you come up with many ideas on kind of smoothing speed bumps like this, right?
We absolutely do. And, you know, we think of our job as curating great public policy solutions for the kind of for the good of all Albertans. And, you know, when you talk about the economy growing, Ted, the good news is in Alberta, our economy is still booming very, very strongly at the moment, which is great news. And that's in the face of what could be some real dark skies internationally, globally, with the threat of maybe even a global recession coming in the not so distant future. Alberta's looking like a bit of a safer port in that storm.
That's good to hear. That's good to hear, Scott, for sure. When it comes to, it may seem like a small issue, you know, the whole term software engineer and using that in the job description where you're trying to woo, you know, good talent here to kind of keep boosting and keep our economy chugging along. But little things do mean something, don't they, Scott?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the software engineer one is not an issue that I've looked into a huge amount, but I think it's indicative of kind of a broader basket of issues, which is credential recognition.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things that absolutely is a speed bump, is a governor to our economy moving as quickly as possible. And I will say that, you know, some good ground has been made both by the government and professional associations in recent years to try and smooth this over. But, you know, it's really simply the idea that if we're inviting people to come to Alberta, we want them to be able to do their highest and best use, you know, to contribute to the economy in their best possible way. And it's also just good for, from a human decency kind of perspective, to have people able to do the profession that they'd really like to do. And right now, I'd say we sort of have a patchwork approach between governing bodies, some self-governing bodies. Some are providing really smooth pathways for people to come from other provinces or even other countries into their professions. And in other cases, it's just taking too long and there can be too many bumps still.
Yeah. First, when you talk about credentials, I'm thinking of, you know, doctors, you know, lawyers, that type of thing, right? That's what you're referring to?
Yeah, certainly. But right on down the list of professions, you know, we could look at building trades, carpenters and pipe fitters or Red Seal chefs, all those sorts of things. I think we want to be able to get those people into positions, you know, as quickly as possible. And one of the things that I sometimes point to with this is, you know, there are other places in the world like Australia and New Zealand that have really robust credential recognition programs between those two countries. And, you know, it's almost easier to move between those two countries than it can be to move between two Canadian provinces and do the same job. And something should just tell us, you know, that doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense.
No kidding. So I had no idea it was that difficult going province to province, you know, to use your credentials.
It certainly can be, and you know, I will say that there's often some historic or good reason, or at least there was a good reason behind why the credentials could be a little bit different. Maybe the codes are a little bit different in one province or another, or maybe a nurse is allowed to do certain things in one province but they're not allowed to do in another. But I think as we step back from this, you know, Ted, if you call up any business in Alberta today and you ask them what's the biggest governor on their growth, what's slowing it down, I'll bet you, you know, 8 out of 10 of them will tell you talent.
Yeah.
Talent and labor, labor availability. So, when you talk about speed bumps affecting our economy, that's probably the biggest issue. You know, I often say when you're in a labor shortage, there are only really two ways out, and that's people and productivity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people being the idea that we could bring more people in to fill the jobs, or productivity, you know, simply the economic term for getting more value from an hour worked, which is a good thing as well. Now, unfortunately, Canada as a whole has been actually pretty poor at growing our productivity over the last number of years, many years. And we've kind of been masking that by bringing in lots of immigration, which is great. Over the course of COVID, though, immigration really, really dropped and productivity didn't really, really increase. And now we're kind of squeezed from both sides.
Okay. Scott, you mentioned a second or two ago that good progress is being made on the whole kind of recognizing credentials kind of issue to deal with here. But what more can we do, do you think, to kind of get us even further along?
Well, I think that we need to establish some sort of timeline, some fixed timelines to say, you know, this is what's a reasonable length of time to recognize someone's credentials. Also, as a, you know, as a society, sort of, you know, as people who are listening to this and involved in public life, we should just sort of adopt the feeling in our gut that it's not going to be okay anymore to have somebody that's got a PhD doing a really entry-level job just because that came from somewhere else or because we're not familiar with it. We just got to get a lot better at streamlining those. You know, I think there are specific examples in specific places. And there's one other thing that we can do, which is the province could do more to identify what kinds of new Canadians or new workers we'd like in Alberta based on their skill sets and sort of nominate them for a fast track to say, you know, we need more truck drivers or we need more tech workers or that kind of thing.
Yeah. Interesting ideas, Scott, as always. I always appreciate your insight. Thank you for this.
Well, thanks a lot, Ted. Nice to speak with you.
You as well. Have a good weekend.
You too.
All right, thank you. That's Scott Crockett, VP of Communications with the Business Council of Alberta, talking about ways we can go even further, right, to smooth out any speed bumps that may be potentially impacting Alberta's economy to continue chugging along. And that whole talent retention and talent attraction keeps coming up again and again and again from many, many, many different groups when it comes to the economy. A chance to focus in on Alberta economics. Rob Roach joins us, as he always does on Friday afternoons. Rob is Deputy Chief Economist and Managing Editor of ATB Economics. Rob, how are you?
I'm doing well, Ted. How are you?
I'm very well. I understand you have a presentation coming up, my friend, and that's what we're talking about today.
Yeah, so next week, Calgary Economic Development very kindly invited myself and others out to a big economic outlook on Wednesday, October 19th, and they wanted me to talk a little bit about sort of the big picture of where's the Alberta economy going. And, you know, we often focus on the short term, and rightly so. There's a lot going on right now, inflation, interest rates. But it got me thinking about some of the longer term challenges, some of which we've talked about on the Hoot before. And so I've come up with five that I think are particularly pressing to be thinking about now and over the long term.
Okay. Number five, aging of the population.
Yeah, not a new one. We've known about this for decades, and we are taking action on it, but arguably not enough. And it's a good thing. It's good that people are living longer, and there's lots of positives, but I don't think we're fully prepared for the economic and social changes that we're going to have to adapt to. So that's number five.
Okay, number four, technology.
Yeah, another one that is probably obvious, but always worth remembering, is just how much this is going to reshape everything in our economy as workers, as businesses, as consumers. So another big one is definitely technology.
For sure. Number three is labor shortages. They're going to be getting worse. Number two is an interesting one, energy transition.
Yeah, and this one, again, very familiar to everyone. And whether we like it or not, you're kind of for or against the future of Alberta oil and gas, and I'm for it. I'd love us to be pumping as much as we can as long as the world is demanding it. But there are forces lined up against that and limited capacity to get it to market. And again, we're making adjustments. It's just there's a lot more work to do if we're going to get ahead of that. Going forward.
No, for sure, for sure. And number one on your list of the top five things kind of a long-term facing our Alberta economy is eroding social cohesion.
Yeah, and that goes beyond economics, of course.
Yeah.
But what makes our economy really work is the trust between people. All the billions of interactions we do with each other in a free market, we have to trust each other. And I think a lot of people are noticing that that is eroding. We're more polarized. We're more, something is amiss. And so that's a big challenge. But getting to just trust each other again or more is going to be pretty important going forward.
Good stuff. Thank you, Rob. Love picking your brain about these things. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Ted.
Have a good day.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. The top five problems, again, according to Rob Roach, the deputy chief economist at ATB Economics. Number five, aging of the population. Number four, technology. Labor shortages. And number three, number two, energy transition. And number one, eroding social cohesion. Research happening right now out of Olds College in Alberta. The research is an ongoing project. It's going to be a multi-year type of thing to measure the results. But essentially, plants are cleaning water, taking out of it, whatever we don't want in there, so you can drink it again. The research right now is on, water beside feedlots in the province. Cleaning, kind of all of the manure and fertilizers and whatnot that end up in this water and making it drinkable again. But think about the uses of this if it's successful. Simply having plants floating on an island, with their roots dangling into the water, removing the things that you do not want in there. Well, Dan Karen is joining me this afternoon to kind of explain all of this to me. Dan is an eco-hydrologist and instructor in the Workland School of Agriculture Technology out of Olds College. Dan, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Ted. It's great to be with you.
Tell me about this research, Dan. It sounds like something so simple, but I'm just imagining that we could use this for very cool things down the road. But so how are you trying to figure out if plants can, remove things that we don't want in water out of the water?
Well, you kind of nailed it there. It is quite simple, right? What we're doing is we're really exploiting a natural process that happens every day in our wetlands, and in our riparian areas, which are the areas right beside our water banks, our rivers and streams. And so plants naturally take up a whole variety of different contaminants, depending on the plants. All plants take up nutrients, right, which is your nitrogen, your phosphorus, potassium, and a whole host of other smaller nutrients out of the water. And so what we're doing is we're really exploiting this natural process, and we're covering these ponds, these contaminated ponds, with these islands, and we're growing plants in these islands, and those plants are establishing root systems underneath the surface of the water and taking up a lot of those contaminants.
I see. Okay, Dan, when you say islands, do you mean like a floating structure that has like the plants kind of dangling below type thing, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a floating island. It's a patented technology that is provided to us through Tanis Conservation Services. And so they're about 8.5 by 4 feet in size, and there's a soil media that sits kind of inside of the island, and then we plug that soil media with a number of different plant species, and they grow on top of the surface of the water as if they were in a soil that kind of like hydroponics, if you could think of it that way.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, is it similar to the way we grow food, you know, hydroponically? That's interesting. Yeah, it's so do different plants remove different things from the water?
Yeah, absolutely, right? So we found that some plant species can remove heavy metals, right? And
wow.
So they're using and other non-metals, and so they're using these islands in the mining sector, for example.
Yeah.
One of the contaminants in the mining sector is selenium, and so they've found great success using these islands to remove selenium from the water. In our case, we're mostly looking at nutrients and some heavy metals and some other contaminants that make the water undesirable for reuse on the farm and the feedlot operation. There's a whole wide variety of different types of uses for these islands. And so it really depends on what contaminants you're trying to target, and that'll help you determine what plant species you should be using.
Yeah. I should remind everyone, I'm chatting with Dan Caron this afternoon. Dan is an eco-hydrologist and instructor out of the Workland School of Agriculture Technology at Olds College. And we're talking about using plants to remove things from water that we don't want in water, essentially. That's boiling it down to the real nuts and bolts here, Dan. And so how are you able to figure out, Dan, how effective these plants are at removing, you know, what you're targeting from the water?
So what we've done is we've set up an experimental design that allows us to, so we monitor these ponds. We've monitored these ponds for the last two seasons, which is from spring to fall. And we collect a baseline data set, basically. And so we really characterize what these ponds look like without the islands in place. And then we've installed the islands. We did that at the end of September. And so now over the next 2 years, we'll collect a really robust data set to show us what these ponds look like with the treatments, and the treatment being the islands on the ponds. And so that's basically how it's done. And so we're collecting very large data sets with a lot of different variables, so we can really try and isolate the impact that these islands are having on the ponds.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so obviously your work is on, you know, ponds near feedlots and trying to remove, you know, undesirables out of the water, targeting there. But a few minutes ago, you mentioned, you know, mining operations. You know, if you want to use plants to remove things from the water connected to mining operations, it seems endless, the kind of applications to what you're researching here, Dan.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, any kind of contained water system is really where these islands could be applicable. They're being used in urban stormwater. So the ponds that we see in our cities that are kind of collecting all of that surface runoff from the rainfall, they've got applications there. They've got applications in the mining sector. We're looking at agriculture is our particular focus for this project. And so feedlots have these large bodies of water, these ponds, these contained ponds that fill up from the runoff that comes off of the feedlot operation. And it typically just sits there and evaporates, right? Because it's contaminated and it's not really useful for anything else. And so our goal is to try and use these islands in a way that we can improve the water quality and hopefully make this water more useful.
Yeah. Where did you get the idea to kind of poke around and explore this, Dan?
Well, I came into this research at Olds College. This is the third phase of the research that's been ongoing at Olds College. And so a former Olds College employee, Ruth Elvestead, she engaged with Stephen Tanis from Tanis Conservation Services, and they started looking at how well these islands were performing in controlled greenhouse environments. Mm-hmm. And so when I came into the project, we're in phase three now. This is kind of the field scale, real world application of these islands. And so I can't take credit for the idea. Well, the idea of phytoremediation, which is using plants to clean up contaminated soils and waters, is has been around for a long time, right? Because we've known that plants have that capability. And so I can't take credit for that idea, but this particular idea was started at Olds College in about 2015, and I came into it about 3 years ago.
Very cool. Dan, I appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you so much, Ted. It was great talking to you. I hope I answered some of your questions, and thanks for the interest.
That's Dan Caron, eco-hydrologist and instructor in the Workland School of Agriculture Technology out of Olds College in the province of Alberta. If you go to the Olds College website, and you search floating island technology, you'll find out all about this cool research that's happening. It's oldscollege.ca, Olds, like with a, like, you know, plural, O-L-D-S college.ca. And then just click on the search field there and type in floating island, and you'll get this research that's happening right now. It's pretty cool what they're doing. And they're also testing the efficacy of different plants. You know, which plant cleans the water the best? Which plant, as you heard Dan talking about, takes, you know, like heavy metals out of the water? Which plant takes, you know, carbon more out of the water? Which plant takes, you know, whatever, salts and other dissolved organic matter, on and on and on and on. So this is very cool. Think about all the stormwater, you know, storage locations around, you know, the cities of Edmonton and Calgary, right? Get plunk 1, 2, 3, 4 of these islands in there and clean that water. You know, take bad stuff out of it before it gets released into the river, you know? Anyway, the applications of this are fantastic, fantastic. So I'm glad that research is happening right here in Alberta.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.